Welcome to the 1515, brought to you by the regulatory legal experts at the Maples Group. Here, you will learn more about the latest developments in the regulatory laws of the Cayman Islands on the 15th day of every month.
Hello and welcome to the April 2024 installment of the Maples Group Regulatory 1515 podcast, where we discuss the latest developments in regulatory law in the Cayman Islands. My name is Patrick Head and I'm a partner on the Regulatory Financial Services team here at the Maples Group. Joining me today is Adam Huckle, a fellow partner in the Cayman Islands office, and Lisa Page, a Regulatory and Financial Services Associate at Maples. In this edition, we will look at the Russian sanctions. There's a new specific licensing ground for divestment, the DOTC's recent bulletin and ongoing enforcement measures, some new CSV technical guidance on beneficial ownership filings, which has been issued, and quickly touching upon the FATF recommendation 15, in particular for VASPs, and recommendation 24, which is guidance on beneficial ownership and transparency of legal arrangements. A quick reminder that this discussion does not constitute legal advice and should be taken as a general update only. If listening in from your usual podcast app, you'll find any resource documents and speaker information in the description. If you've clicked on the media player link sent to you via email, you can find this information in the notes section. Last but not least, don't forget to subscribe. Okay, thanks both Adam and Lisa for what I understand is actually our anniversary edition. So we've now been doing the podcast for over a year. Appreciate you both joining me this afternoon. Adam, let's start with the new divestment licensing ground under the Russian sanctions.
Yeah, no problem, Pat. Ever since Russia's invasion of Ukraine back in 2022, UK sanctions have made it very difficult for Cayman Islands investment funds to divest themselves of either sanctioned investments held by the fund in Russia, i.e. downstream investments, and or to remove sanctioned investors from their registers, i.e. upstream investors. A new legislative amendment that came into force in the Cayman Islands on the 14th of March may now make both a possibility. Stepping back, and as a general matter, Cayman funds have always been able to apply to the governor here for a specific license to permit an activity that would otherwise be prohibited by the asset freezing measures under Cayman sanctions law. These, of course, take time and they're not wholly discretionary. And what I mean by that is that such license applications must be made and specific licenses can only be granted under one or more specific licensing grounds that are set out in the legislation. Now, until recently, no such licensing ground really existed to deal with the difficulties Cayman funds have faced regarding frozen investments in Russia and sanctioned investors on their registers. There are arguments that the pre-existing grounds ought to have applied, but ultimately, the UK sanctions authorities didn't seem to agree.
So just to pause there, I mean, it's an interesting point. So does that mean to date, Adam, despite best efforts, it's actually been almost impossible to obtain a license in the context of most funds so far?
Certainly on the upstream investors, i.e. trying to exit your sanctioned investors from the fund. Yes, that's been the case. That appears now to have changed though, Pat, because on the 14th of March, a new divestment specific licensing ground came into force. This ground hasn't been drafted specifically with offshore investment funds in mind. For example, there's no mention of investment funds in the wording, but on the face of that wording, and certainly as we interpret it, Cayman funds can now apply for specific licenses that, if those licenses are granted by the governor with the prior consent of the UK Secretary of State, would do two things. So first, the downstream investment element. A license would enable the Cayman Fund to transfer funds or economic resources that are located in Russia and which the fund owns, holds, or controls to a designated person or the Russian government in order for the Cayman Fund to divest itself wholly or partially of those funds or economic resources. Now, on its face, that downstream investment element should apply to, for example, situations where a fund holds shares in Russian companies, whether those companies are sanctioned or not. Now, the license might, again, for example, allow the Russian company itself to repurchase those shares, which in turn might be helpful if the Cayman Fund hasn't been able to transfer those shares to a non-sanctioned person, either because it hasn't been able to find a willing purchaser, because the purchase price wasn't acceptable, or because of Russia's own counter-sanctions, which typically restrict Russian companies' dealings with those from unfriendly countries such as the UK and its overseas territories. Now, secondly, the upstream investment element. Now, in that, the license might enable the Cayman Fund to acquire, that's the word, from a designated person or the Russian government, an interest that's held in that Cayman Fund by that designated person or the Russian government. Now, in our view, we're clear that acquire in that scenario equates to, for example, a compulsory redemption of shares or a withdrawal of limited partnership interest from a Cayman investment fund. However, that redemption or withdrawal can only be licensed if the sole consideration for the acquisition, i.e., in my context, the redemption withdrawal proceeds, is a transfer of funds from the Cayman Fund to the designated person or the Russian government, and that consideration, again in our context, redemption withdrawal proceeds, are credited to a frozen account in a jurisdiction where corresponding, that's the word, asset freezing, licensing, and exception sanctions measures are in force, which in practice means you've got to transfer the proceeds to a frozen account that's either held by a Cayman Islands bank or, if held by a foreign bank, the account has to be situated either in the Cayman Islands, in another British overseas territory, or the UK. Now, as a result, there are some practical hurdles to overcome when considering applying for such an upstream divestment license. Questions such as, who needs to hold the frozen account? Is there such an account available? Will banks agree to receive such funds, etc.? But these ought to be able to be overcome in most instances, and we're actively advising clients on how all this might work out in practice. The kicker is that we don't yet know how the Cayman authorities and ultimately the UK sanctions authorities will approach this new divestment ground in the context of Cayman investment funds. The new ground has only been in force for just under a month, and unfortunately, that is too early for anyone to have received a decision on a license application on that ground, even if one had been made the moment the ground came into force. And there's no official guidance on the new ground at all. And in addition, any license from the governor only resolves the Cayman Islands sanctions part. Now, in the real world, there may be other jurisdictions' sanctions laws that apply to the divestment transaction. For example, those are the US, OFAC, the EU, or indeed, as I mentioned, Russia's own counter-sanctions. Now, Cayman Islands license wouldn't be binding on any of those. And counterparty de-risking when it comes to sanctions can also be a practical obstacle. But in sum, this new divestment-specific licensing ground is certainly a potential opportunity to consider for Cayman funds with a sanctions nexus, particularly those who have a real need to exit such investments and or investors, such as funds that are nearing the end of their life cycle and wishing to wind up and liquidate in the ordinary way. Back to you, Pat.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. I think that it's certainly interesting and obviously very helpful to have a new possible alternative route here, because I think, one of the unintended consequences of the Russian sanctions has been sort of to lock up a lot of funds, that is capital, in investment vehicles, which have either become frozen and whole because of threshold limits being reached with a sanctioned investor, or that have otherwise not been able to wind down fully, as you've said. I think it's been sort of a growing problem for the financial services industry globally. So, it's interesting to see these measures, and I'm sort of aware of jurisdictions as well that are allowing some of their sort of divestment mechanics, which, will certainly be welcomed by industry. Okay, Lisa, so if I can bring you into the discussion here, I think sort of quickly we can go over the most recent DITC bulletin that was issued. If you could give us sort of an update just on the key points that the DITC are trying to make this industry aware of, that would be great.
Yeah, absolutely, Pat. In March, the DITC published its latest update bulletin. There were two topics covered within the bulletin. The first topic was concerning the CRS missing dates of birth filed in its standard Excel format. Upon the DITC's review of the CRS returns that had been submitted for the 2022 reporting period, the DITC had noted that about 10% of financial institutions, or FIs, had failed to report a date of birth for individual account holders and or controlling person. So the DITC is taking this opportunity to remind industry that the CRS regulations require that the date of birth be reported for all individuals who are considered to be reportable persons. It is generally expected that an FI will hold date of birth information within its records, irrespective of whether the account is a pre-existing account under CRS due to AML obligations, such as the requirement to collect a valid passport that contains a date of birth as part of performing standard customer due diligence. So therefore, looking forward, the DITC will review submitted returns as part of its annual compliance and enforcement activities, with a focus on FIs that fail to report a date of birth.
Yeah, it's surprising because I think that in most cases, you know, the very limited circumstances where you don't need to provide date of birth is where you are a non-reportable person, which effectively means from a CRS context, a US individual. So really for anybody else, it's surprising that that information is not already being included on returns. And obviously I think for all clients listening, that is a good point to take away, and particularly given the DOTC's vigilance in terms of checking the filed returns and also the likelihood that you would receive a compliance notice and potentially a penalty breach notice for failing to provide accurate information.
Right. And there was a second topic as well that was covered in the DOTC updates bulletin. Now, that was on the 2023 CRS and factor reporting deadlines for FI. So we understand now that the DOTC portal is currently open for 2023 CRS and factor uploads. And so in-scope entities must be registered and use the portal to complete these filings. So just a couple of deadlines to take note of. So on the 30th of April, registration or the notification is due. On the 31st of July, the 2023 CRS reporting on reportable accounts, the CRS filing declaration, and the 2023 FACTA reporting are all due. And then finally, on the 16th of September, the 2023 CRS compliance form is due. And just noting that there is an additional day that's been added in there because the 15th lands on a Sunday. And so as we've previously seen, failure to meet these deadlines or a misclassification may lead to the administrative penalty or fine enforcement.
Yeah, and I'm aware that you've obviously been quite busy recently receiving various notifications from the DOTC.
Yes, I keep you busy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just, you know, one of those points that, you know, clients need to be, you know, as I mentioned, very aware that the DOTC does have accurate records and that they are very timely in following up with entities that have missed their filing deadlines or have provided inaccurate information. And I think that, you know, frankly, some of the excuses are starting to wear a bit thin. It's a good timely reminder there. So thanks for that. Just changing topics now, I understand that there was some recent sort of technical guidance, possibly more for registered officers than industry generally, but to do with the beneficial ownership filing regime. Have you seen any updates in that regard?
Yeah. So on the 15th of March, the General Registry issued technical guidance and a notice in preparation for filings that would be made under the new Beneficial Ownership Transparency Act once that comes into force. So taking each in turn, the technical guidance discusses changes to the current Excel files. That includes reference to things like new data fields for the beneficial ownership's nationality and the BO's mechanism of control. With respect to the accompanying notice, that states that the Ministry of Financial Services and Commerce will issue guidance on what to do in the event of receipt of error messages at a later date, as well as will issue general guidance on beneficial ownership obligations in response to industry demand. Also, the notice states that the commencement date of the Act and the accompanying regulations will be included in a subsequent advisory, and importantly, that compliance with the new elements of the beneficial ownership framework will be required by the 1st of January 2025.
Thanks, Lisa. That's relatively illuminating, I would say, in terms of the general timelines there. And certainly industry will be keen to see the more general guidance once it's published. Just noted there is coming out for consultation. And I think that the point about framework being required for compliance from 1 January next year. Just moving on now, I think there were also a couple of recent updates with regard to FATF recommendations. There was recommendation 15 and 24. If you're able to give us the rundown on those, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, happy to, Pat. So with respect to the FATF recommendation 15, On the 28th of March, they had published a table within a report on the status of implementation of Recommendation 15 by FATF members and jurisdictions with materially important virtual asset service provider, or VASP, activity in accordance with the FATF standards on virtual assets and VASPs. Now, this report follows a 12-month process of collecting and evaluating relevant information from jurisdictions. The purpose really behind this was to issue this table in the context of the increasing need to regulate virtual assets, which inherently span cross borders, as well as the growing threat of ransomware incidents demanding payment in virtual assets. So the Cayman Islands notably was included within this table, and it has taken a number of steps since 2021 on VASP activity. So for example, the Cayman Islands has conducted risk assessments, it's enacted legislation and regulation requiring VASPs to be registered or licensed, and it has also taken enforcement action or other supervisory action against VASPs. And just interestingly to compare, the Cayman Islands seems to be in a similar position to other jurisdictions, including countries like Canada, the United States, and France.
Well, that's good to hear. Welcome news that we are sort of broadly compliant and leading the charge, it seems, globally on putting in place those measures. So hopefully that's encouraging for those listeners out there who are interested in setting up a VASP in Cayman. So then, yeah, recommendation 24 as well, I think, was the second recommendation.
Yeah, so with respect to recommendation 24, on the 11th of March, the FATF published some revised guidance on beneficial ownership and transparency of legal arrangements that prescribes ways to understand and assess money laundering and terrorist financing risks associated with trusts and other legal arrangements in relation to this recommendation. So just briefly, the publication discusses the importance of having adequate, accurate, and up-to-date information on beneficial ownership, as well as mechanisms and sources for obtaining beneficial ownership information. Also, the publication highlights the significance of international cooperation, since such arrangements may potentially be abused to facilitate cross-border money laundering and terrorist financing activities. And notably, we understand that the FATF intends to assess countries' implementation of these requirements during its upcoming round of mutual evaluations.
Thanks for that, Lisa. Again, very helpful to have that quick rundown. That concludes today's episode, so I'd like to thank both Adam and Lisa for joining. Feel free to reach out to them or anyone else in the regulatory team to discuss further for bespoke advice. And to our listeners, if you found this informative, give us a 5-star on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Thank you for listening and subscribing.